My name is Dan Brown, and today I'm here with another A Lens A Day, conversations about information architecture. And today I get to talk to the limitless Andreas Resmini. Andreas, old friend, thank you for joining me on this.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
I've been talking to folks about process a lot. I've been trying to understand how people do IA, but I know two things about you. You are a teacher and you are as avid about games as I am. So I'm going to put you on the spot and say, ask you to maybe riff a little bit on what can we learn about IA process from games? What is it about games that help us think through how to do this work? Is it okay that I put you on the spot like that?
It's absolutely okay. I think that I'm more putting you on the spot than anything else. But yeah, so we are both avid players, and you have an infinite amount of knowledge on games that I love to tap into when we meet. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened for the past few years. Games have been a huge part of what I've been working on in respect to IA for the past few years, because that's been one of the major sort of like wake-up calls for me when I started to look into the idea of complexity. That was one of the things that moved me from what we normally call the polar bear IA, right? The more sort of like library and information science-based type of things that we used to do in the 90s, to the idea that, well, we're going physical, we're going outside of the confines of screens. And this brings in an enormous amount of complexity that we were not used to handle before, that we used to handle differently. So games became a way for me at the beginning to try and figure out, oh, I have a nice little complex system over here, but it's in a box, right? Because we're talking mostly about board games from this perspective. And there are rules to these things, and I can easily explain, you know, well, sometimes not very easily depending on the game, but let's say I can easily explain to people how the game works, and we can play it out, which means experience it, engage with it, be immersed in it, pretend we are pirates, tycoons, criminals, whatever we want to be, and get to the end with results that are always sort of like a little bit surprising, right? It's not a given that we win, or it's not a given that we lose, even if the game is going in a certain way. And this became a tool for students in my courses, sort of like as a way for them to understand complexity in a controllable way. So they could sit down and not be immediately sort of like have to go, all right, we need to design information architecture for an airport. Where do we start from? Which would be, oh God, I don't know. Food, people, planes, logistics, cars, you know, anything. But we could start from, here's a little game that is called Flux, for example. It's very simple. It's a meta game. You know it very well. The rules are made up as you play, but then you start thinking and you start, you know, considering that you might add flavors to it. So you have Star Wars, or you have Monty Python, or you have Pirates Flux, and they're all the same game, but they feel very different. And you start to reason on this thing. So I built a system starting from there by looking at what game design theorists such as Tracy Fullerton have been doing. And they've been sort of like saying, well, when you look at games, you can look at what they call formal elements, like for example, rules, right? Or resources, how many dice do we have? How much money can we spend and so on? But there are also dramatic elements. What is the story about? Who is the, you know, does it matter that I'm a criminal as opposed to a policeman, for example? And then on the basis of that, I built an additional category, which wasn't really there, which is the idea of spatial elements, because we use them. And those are the information architecture basis for me, because we talk about relationship, or is this inside another thing? Is this connected to another thing? Is this not connected to another thing? Is it a tree? Is it a rhizome? Is it another structure? And using these three different sets of elements, you start to build up the complete information architecture for example, a game. But in this case, a game is a very nice, very well-known cultural artifact that allows me to say, well, now you have played the game, you can build the game, you enjoy the game with a small controllable. Now let's talk about another game, the airport. And we have a set of tools, of course, not only those, but a set of tools that allows us to break down the initial structure and start the process, not from the top, not from the idea of, you know, let's make an app or what is the website going to look like, but more about what are all of the elements and how do they play together. And of course, the spatial elements, is this thing connected? Is this thing close by? Is this thing far away? Have a role? But also the dramatic elements. Am I a traveler or am I the pilot of a plane? Am I a person doing security? So I do have a different role in the game, if you allow me, just to keep with the airport example. And then you get to the rules as well. You get to know, well, what do you need? Well, I need a passport. I don't need to carry guns if I want to travel. I do need to do certain things at a certain moment that flow into the process. But this way allows me to break it into manageable parts that are still sort of like one single ecosystem from that perspective. So games have been incredibly useful. And of course, this is ongoing work. So that could be, you know, a thousand things that we could say, but that's sort of like the crux of all the process.
That was great. Yeah, games do have surprising endings, especially when you play with folks who are, say, emotionally invested in winning or losing.
Oh, yeah.
I have found that sometimes pieces end up on the floor because people are very upset about the outcomes of those games. You frame this as kind of a way of getting started with an IA or a design problem, right? Like, okay, this and the design of an airport feels huge, but if we can break it down into these pieces, that helps us get engaged in the process. And I wanted to tease that out a little bit more. And I wonder if, from your perspective, it seems like the students might find starting as the hardest part of the design process. Is that, in your experience, true, that starting is what the thing that they struggle the most with? Or do you reveal to them that essentially it's hard all the way through, or that there are moments that are even harder than simply getting started? Does my question make sense at all?
It does. And I would argue that it's not just students. I also find this with the occasional clients. I still do a few projects, you know, choice projects along the way. But also when you do executive education with companies, so workshopping or, you know, teaching seminars and this sort of things, we use this sort of exercises a lot. And the one thing that we normally do is that we spend quite a lot of time in that phase, which I think is typical of the way, at least I approach information architecture. What is the problem, actually? And not what is the solution or how we want to get there, which is normally also when I find that, for example, professional clients tend to end up, right? There seems to be an idea that we already have the problem circumscribed, but then you dig a little, maybe using traditional tools like, you know, the five whys or something else, and you figure out that actually they are trying to do something that is not, for example, yeah, to build a website or to build a mobile app or to have, you know, this and that, but they have a different need that just haven't sort of like. So in one way, to answer what you're saying, starting is definitely difficult. And if I were to put that on a scale based on my own experience, it's more difficult for students than it is for professionals or for companies, for sure. There is one thing, though, that I must say in favor of students, and is that once they get the engine running, once they've spent enough time in that initial phase and have been provided with the tools, they, of course, do not have the constraints that you normally find inside just the politics or even, you know, the budget of a company. So you tend to have a much more sort of like liberating phase as you move along, which means solution might be crazy, but it doesn't become harder as you go along. It might become a little bit, you know, disappointing because you intended to save the world and you can't, right? You understand that your solution is limited, which is of course also a lesson in certain cases. But I would argue it's more difficult with companies, at least again in my experience, because then you start to have, yeah, it would be wonderful to do this, but we don't have the budget, but that part of the company doesn't follow, but we need to do something else because the vision strategically goes somewhere else. And then you have, you know, all of the compromises and the things that we normally deal with when we actually create something in the real world that make your original information architecture really, really difficult to execute as it is in your mind or in your drawings or in the drawings of the team at that time. So does it answer your question?
Yeah. And it sort of reminds, again, just to bring it back to games, the nature of a game is to not get stuck on a single strategy, right? As you're playing the game, you constantly need to adjust your strategy because of other elements that you may not be aware of, or politics, that is other players making moves that interfere with your strategy. And I certainly, when I play games, what I teach my kids when we're playing games is, don't get annoyed when someone takes the space you are wanting. Think about how to play it differently. You had mentioned Flux earlier, and I realized it's almost the perfect illustration of not understanding the problem. Like, you go into Flux thinking it's about one thing, and as you play the game, you realize it is about something else entirely.
Yeah, and always changing. That's the point, right? Because you think you can have a strategy, but the strategy can be sort of like thrown out of the window in two rounds by other people that can change the rules of the game itself, which is a very interesting lesson in the way we actually deal with complex situations when we think we are in control, like a company that controls a certain part of the market, but doesn't really. Or, you know, it's always open to the fact that, especially with digital today, you tilt very, very easily from we are in complete control to, oh, this is a disaster, and we don't have the pulse of the market anymore. There are very interesting things with games also when it comes to the emotional angle of things that allow us to have insights into the information architecture from different ways. One of the games that we play, and we play this at executive workshops as well, is normally Werewolf, right? That you probably know very well, or for those who don't know Werewolf, a mafia variant, right? So where you, one person or more than one person are werewolves and the others are villagers, and you know, you need to get rid of the werewolves before they kill everybody. I normally have people play this, and then I introduce my own variants for the cards, which is not meant to be played. It's just meant to irk people, because it basically changes just the names on the cards and says something like police and immigrants and citizens. And you get to figure out that the people who get citizens just go, oh, I don't really understand this. It's just villager with a different name. But the people who get immigrants sort of like feel like, wait a second, what are we doing here? And you don't play that for the sake of it. We don't really play it, but it's just a way to gauge their reaction. And just the point, I just changed a label. I didn't tell you anything else. I just, you know, changed that thing, said a word before that you could understand. And now there's another word that you still understand, but that changes everything, right? So when we are moving into this space, you understand very well, because some people might just throw the cards, as you were saying, you know, flip the table to say, I'm not doing this, and you get out of the room. I don't want to talk to you anymore. But it's interesting, right? You're playing with the information architecture of it. You haven't even touched the game itself in terms of the way it plays out, or the interactions. You changed a label, really, just the label. And it's a very interesting way to sort of like show to people that the hidden structures that you have in place are the ones that we need all to play by. And some of them do not belong to the game, but belong to society, like in this case, right? Because you are not saying anything about what is the situation inside the game. Maybe the immigrants are the good guys, right? But you don't say that. People are just bringing in their own experience, and that relates to the world we live in. And you immediately go, oh, no, not good.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's another illustration too of what if you had done that 10 years ago or 20 years ago, absolutely. Like just the context of the world that we live in changes over time, or 100 years ago, if you had done that.
Absolutely.
You know, the context of the world changes, and we bring that baggage to the table when we look at an information architecture. So it's a great illustration of, we can't design these structures in a vacuum, right? We can't design these structures assuming that people are blank slates when they show up to experience it. I feel like this is a good opportunity for us to bring the lens in. So can you say which lens we picked for you, and maybe describe it in your own words?
Yeah, so we picked the familiar relationships card, which is actually very, very interesting. And it's about the relationships that can exist between content in the largest possible way. You describe it as, you know, the idea that these can follow a family tree, because topics have parents, siblings, children, right? So, and then the question for the person who has the cards in their hands is how they can translate this structure. Must all children be treated the same way? So are there differences, for example? And how recursive can the content be, or should you allow it to be? Can a children be a parent, for example? And do we need to accommodate things that we didn't think about at the beginning, for example, like cousins, right? Topics that are not there. And in the end, you have the big question, which is, how does the navigation represent the hierarchical relationships of content in there, right? So it's a lovely way to bring in, I think, the basic principles where information architecture sort of like sits in, right? What are the relationships among things?
Right.
One of the things. I think you had Dan Klein before, and he was talking a lot about things in the word dude of things. And, I'm with him on that. These are things, even if it's content, so.
I mean, you had described, I loved how you sort of broke down a game into formal elements, dramatic elements, right? You took that from Tracy Fullerton, and then you added this idea of spatial elements. And I feel like the familial relationships are sort of a stand-in for spatial relationships, right? This idea that one way that we can imagine the space is to create these kinds of parental or sibling connections between things, as you say. Talk to me about maybe some of the shortcomings or the ways in which you feel like familiar relationships don't encompass the way in which you envision spatial elements.
I think there is one of the major issues I always have, and not with the card, but with the way we tend to go at these things, is that humans tend to see things in a linear way. We are projected into our own narratives, and our narratives are linear. I woke up this morning, I did a few things, I had a meeting with you later on in the day, so I can read that as a sequence of elements. And the tree, in some ways, even though it breaks up in many different branches, sort of like still brings in this idea that we are following through a certain path. We're moving from item at level one to get all the way to level five through a number of different elements. So that's probably the one thing that I sort of like try to not think about too much when it comes to the idea of family. More for the idea maybe of what could be considered to be, I don't know, an Italian or Mediterranean family, where, you know, there's a lot of confusion. Now, we're not really sure if that's really our uncle or somebody else's uncle, or maybe, you know, if the second, you know, cousin with somebody else or whatever. But everybody's sort of like there. And when it's Christmas, it's like chaos, right? And I'm not saying that I like that kind of situation, but it's a good picture for the type of things that we are having. When it comes to the way we connect families, I think that in your cards, the point that you make about cousins is the one thing that sort of like always sort of like I want to bring into the conversation. As much as you can start with something that feels orderly at the beginning, because you are trying to build structure, we know very well that there's always going to be this famous thing with the other category, right? The cousins, or, you know, the weird uncle with his pants drop that comes in at Christmas saying, you know, Happy Easter to everybody, while the family doesn't even, you know, consider that. So the idea is that I want that to be more flexible. So I tend to always consider the possibility that there are multiple ontologies in place. And these normally considered to be multiple different ways of build, I wouldn't use the word tree, but different orders that sort of like cater to different people. So my starting point is never the tree, but probably more like systems or system map, if you want to picture something, where you try to figure out what are the general relationships about that. I do the same in one of the things that I developed along the years and we discussed early on somehow in pervasive information architecture, but it has become most of my work in the past few years as a way to describe ecosystems, relationships in ecosystems. We start from what we call paths, which are sort of like a version of customer journeys, but built around spatial rules in the sense that there are vicinity, proximity, and these sort of things. But then I end up with a map, which is built with hexagons, which is takes away any sort of thing which is directional. And the reason is because people tend to look at directions. So if I give them a tree, then we'll see, okay, where's my starting point? Where's my end point? So as a tool for us to get some order into something, very useful because we want to have categories, we want to have things in there. As a way to break down things, I'm more, if you want, on the latch side of things, if we think about Richardson Woman. So, and even there, with the multiple, you know, ways to splice down or to splice up the hat rack, right? So you can do location, you can do alphabet, you can do time by saying, oh, let's put the hats in order of the people who arrived in the house, or let's put the hat in order of chronological, you know, purchase, or maybe chronological existence in the world, right? Whatever. But then if we look at these things, they're still all spatial metaphors, if you allow me. Location, very clearly, but the alphabet is a sequence. We know very well what it means. It's B comes after A and before C. It's again, placing things in relationship to each other in a way that for us is very spatial, because that's the way we think. There is no, and this is sort of like the root of everything. So when you're saying tree and when you're saying familial, what I'm looking at is really, what is the vicinity between these two concepts? And I interpret that in a very, very embodied way. That's my root as an architect. I do come from the idea that embodiment is what we actually use to understand everything we have around. And we know that neurophysiology has been supporting that. So we perfectly know that that's the way our brain body system actually interprets, you know, navigation of digital space, just like we do in physical space. But the interesting part is that when you are trying to understand these things, you always fall back to the idea that you, Dan, are close to my heart. I say close, it means you are close to me, even if in a sort of like in my mind or in my soul, if that exists, or whatever is my consciousness, right? If I don't want to think about you, I push you away or I put you away. I lock you up somewhere, right? And we do the same with all the things that we need. The things that we need are close at hand. The things that we don't need, either physical or conceptual or anything, we just, you know, place them somewhere where they don't bother us. That's kind of like the root. So familial, I don't have the picture of a tree in mind, but I have a picture of the relationship that exists between these different people. And I can add one thing, the more we break it down, the more we create relationships, cousins, you know, twice removed on my mother's side or whatever, the more our information architecture becomes large because we keep adding elements and we increase the number of relationships that we have. It's the usual thing, right? At a certain point, I need to stop and understand using design principle when that's enough. It's good to have your socks, maybe, I don't know, winter and summer socks. It's not a good thing to have, this is the black sock, this is the black sock, but it's short and summer. And because then you have 100 drawers with one sock each, and that's not useful. So that's the way I approach the familial thing, which is, I hope it makes sense, because I'm trying to sort of like probably break down my own way of approaching in 3 minutes, and it's kind of complicated.
Yeah, no, no, I really like what you're saying, and it makes me think I need to add a new lens to the day, but that's another story. But I like, I will often say when I'm talking to a client and we're really kind of struggling to get our arms around a structure, I'll use a tree metaphor and I'll talk about the trunk and the branches as the way to get to the leaves, right? And the leaves are where the value is for their particular users. But we all know that even though this doesn't happen in reality, in our virtual systems, leaves can become branches, right? Leaves can sort of, the things that we think of as destinations can ultimately grow to become trees in and of themselves, right? Absolutely. And so the whole metaphor breaks down. What I like about what you're saying is, you're saying don't start hierarchically, don't start at the top. Let's start with the thing that adds value and talk about proximity to that thing. So when you talk about making a map on a hexagonal grid, to me that says there's no starting point and ending point, or let me say that differently. Every node can be a starting point, right? And when which is, I think, a much better analogy to how people interact with digital structures.
That's exactly what I mean. And it has a reason for that. And I can explain it very, very briefly, but I want also to sort of like, not address, but sort of like make a point about what you just said. Of course, I also do the same. If I'm, maybe entering a project where people are sort of like starting to, have issues with just understanding that we need to agree on some kind of structure before maybe deciding the color of buttons, right? Just to make the usual example. Then of course I will start by, bringing in things that they might relate to, and that might be a tree. There is a difference between knowing the tool that you need to use and some of the conversations, like the one that I was trying to have about trying to figure out a different conceptual model that you could use in some ways when it's more useful. It's really different. And I think that one of the major things, for example, that I try to teach the students, and that I'm pretty sure that we do when we are discussing these things also with you and the other people in the community of practice, is that I never say, guys, you're doing trees, that's the wrong thing, and we should all do, this incredible map with hexagons. It's more like, there's one more tool that could be useful in situations where people have sort of like understood what you're saying with trees, but we need to consider these sort of like more open structures that are typical of what we have with digital, especially, and that's the reason why we bring it in, because the one thing that digital in physical, sort of like the idea of blending that we talk about all the time, means is that we have a person really at the center of everything. Call it a radical user-centered approach if you want, but it's like, we've been talking about users or something else, I normally say actors, but doesn't really matter, for ages now. But we always started from the company perspective in some way. That's the client, right? So the client wants something. The idea is that when I'm doing something, paying my taxes, I don't know, having a physical, working on my education, maybe traveling somewhere, I am at the center because of digital. I can actually really decide that I want to check out Amazon anytime when I look, at a window and from a shop to decide whether or not I want to buy that certain things or not. And do the same at every single moment. And I can branch out at any moment sometimes because of both the information I carry with me because of mobile technology, but also because of the information we bring into the environment through, all the systems that we're embedding into streets and cities and buildings, which means we have much more information and we are not in control, that's the word I don't want to use, but much more open to the possibility of changing direction that we were when we were discussing, here's the website, you go there, and that's the menu, and you can click on these things, and that's it. I can really leave the website, but not by going to another website. I can really leave and do another thing entirely. When I pay, I can decide to do it in 5 different ways. And which one I'm going to pick really depends also in the about, it's one of the things depending on the environment I'm in, not just on how good is your website.
Yeah. Andres, I think we will have to leave it there. That was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.